1490 AM in Montreal.
Hello, you're listening to CJLO News. Maintenance workers for the STM, Montreal's transit authority, are on strike to renew their collective agreement, which expired in January. The workers with the Montreal Transit Union want better working conditions, more reliable schedules, and an end to private outsourced contracting. The strike has significantly reduced bus and metro schedules in the city. On the fourth day of the strike, June 12th, at 7 a.m., about 150 maintenance workers gathered outside of the STM offices on St. Laurent for a demonstration. This rally came shortly after the announcement that Quebec had appointed a mediator in the negotiations between the STM and the union. Jacqueline Maeve is a maintenance worker who cleans and maintains parts necessary for the metro lines. CJLO spoke with Maeve at that early morning rally.
I'm hoping that the mediator can help bring better results because the negotiations have not been going very favorable as so far.
Scheduling is a key issue for workers who are being asked to work two weekends a month instead of one as the 12-hour work week is being reformulated. They also want a 25% pay bump, improvements to aging and dangerous infrastructure, and an end to private outsourced contracts, which they say threaten their jobs and the safety of commuters.
We already have the personnel that has been working in this field for years. We are experts. We know what we're doing. We have all the equipment to do the jobs. So why send it private where it's going to cost more? Who's going to pay for that in the end? Either the quality is going to pay for it, or the clientele is going to pay for it with higher fares. So we're fighting for the public, and we're fighting for the service, and we're fighting for ourselves as well.
Quebec's Labour Minister Jean Boulet stated on social media that he hopes his appointed mediator will, quote, reestablish a dialogue conducive to negotiations and ease tensions between the parties, unquote. STM CEO Marie-Claude Lenard also stated that this was, quote, a step in the right direction, unquote. There have been 70 meetings between union negotiators and the STM officials at the time of this report. The last collective agreement took over 170 meetings to reach. Bus and metro services are at 50% during off-peak hours. The union agreed to run full service during the Grand Prix racing event, June 14th, 15th, and 16th. The strike is set to end on June 17th. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Go to the nude beach. Wave to all your friends as they swim in the sea. Let's take off our clothes, let's let the sky see us. Don't care what we got is quite enough. Yes, I feel the air. Feel it blow and whistle all the way through my hair. No, I cannot see it.
Championship, isn't it? And I guess we'd said, and you'd said, Zach had said, it's going to happen at some point.
Your memory. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Tommy John Show here on CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hope everyone's doing well. We have a jam-packed show for you guys this week. The Montreal Canadian Grand Prix wrapped up yesterday. We'll get into that. The United States Open has a surprising new champion. We'll get into that. Major trades happening in the world of baseball. We will get into that, as well as Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final tomorrow and Game 5 of the NBA Finals tonight. We will get into all of that over the next hour here on the Tommy John Show. But if you're new to the program, remember to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, you name it. The Tommy John Show is on it. And immediately following the show, before 5 o'clock or so, we will post it up on Instagram if you missed anything. So remember to follow us at the Tommy John Show. So, why don't we start off like we always do, a quick recap. We'll start off with the NHL, the Stanley Cup Finals. And after just a chaotic first week when we had going in the last show, it was 1-1, didn't know what was going to happen. Since then, you had two blowouts and a dramatic win. Game 3, it was all Florida, 6-1, not much to talk about there. Edmonton somehow get off the mat, being down 3-0 in the first period. Leon Draisaitl wins it in overtime, despite Reinhardt tying it late. And Edmonton got what they wanted, a split going down to Florida. They got it. They had home ice. And they were looking to put all the pressure on the Florida Panthers on Saturday night. They were at home. Series tied at 2, looking to keep home ice. And they were flat. Edmonton came out flat, let's be honest. Yes, McDavid had a 2-on-1 chance early on in the game, but after that, the ice was completely tilted in the Florida Panthers' favor. Brad Marchand looks better than he ever has. And as a Bruins fan, it's fun to see Brad Marchand play that well, but you were thinking, my God, we weren't going to give him $7 million a year. He's going to make more than that now. Now, I understand he's on the third line there, and he's doing everything they're asking of him, and the Panthers are a far better roster than the Bruins. I understand that. But this version of Brad Marchand looks healthy, looks hungry, looks motivated. And right now, him and Sam Bennett have just been the two best players for the Florida Panthers. And yes, Forsling's been great, and Mikkola's been great, and Lindell's been great. Barkov defensively's been awesome. They've all been good. But Bennett and Marchand have completely changed the series. They are the two heavy Conn Smythe favorites for the Florida Panthers. And now, after a dominant, I know it was 5-2, that was a dominant win by the Florida Panthers, they will look to wrap up the Stanley Cup tomorrow at home in Sunrise, Florida, looking to go back-to-back. But if you're Edmonton, you're still in this series. Last time you played down there in Florida, you got the win, you fought back. The real interesting thing that's going to come out of this game in Game 5 is who starts in goal for the Edmonton Oilers. Will it be Pickard? Will it be Stuart Skinner? I have a funny feeling it's going to be Stuart Skinner. When in doubt, they usually go back to him. They could not start him in Game 5 after what Pickard did, coming in relief in Game 4, so I understand that. But I would be surprised if Skinner doesn't start Game 6, but some of the lineup changes made by Chris Knobloch, and I like Chris Knobloch. 2 years as the head coach of the Oilers, they've gone to 2 Cup Finals, so he clearly knows what he's doing. But some of the lineup changes I do not like at all. Klingberg being out of the lineup for Game 4, okay, understand that, but not having him in the lineup for Game 5 after his replacement, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, couldn't do anything. That didn't make sense. They need a puck-moving defenseman. That's what Klingberg does best. You had last change. You can get better matchups. Was stunned that he was not in the lineup. And another lineup change that I didn't like was having Kapanen out. Kapanen's been an energizer bunny this whole series. He has speed. He can play with a little grit. I was stunned when they kept Jeff Skinner in the lineup over him. And nothing against Jeff Skinner. Not a playoff kind of a guy. He's got a good shot. He's quick, but he's not fast per se anymore, and he doesn't really do anything physically. So to me, I'm sorry to Jeff Skinner. He had a great career with Carolina. He's got a huge contract to go to the Sabres. Now he's on Edmonton. You have to draw out. I'm sorry. But yeah, that's just the way it's going to go. You have to get Kapanen back in that lineup, and I would get Klingberg back in the lineup. And Klingberg out for Game 5 made no sense to me. Second change, you need puck-moving defenseman. You can get better matchups with him. I would have put him in the lineup for Game 5. But now that's done, and Knobloch had to answer questions on that, which he did. But it looks like they're going to put Klingberg back in, I would expect. And then they have to find a way for Kasperi Kapanen to play. If they don't, then I don't know. And another thing I would do is try and get Evander Kane more involved in this series. He's a physical guy. And previous rounds playing along Leon Draisaitl, to me, they got to go back to doing that. I know he hasn't played great, and he's had some trouble staying out of the penalty box. I understand that. That's fine. But to me, you got to have Evander Kane in that top six hitting people, and you got to find a way for Kapanen to play. He's not going to be on the second line or first line, but him to be in that bottom six with his speed, with his tenacity, I think would do wonders for the Oilers. And I was surprised that he drew out in Game 5. And now on Arvidsson, he's back in the lineup. Okay, I get why he was out, just trying to see what they can do, but I expect him to be in the lineup for Game 6. So right now, to me, they got to roll with Klingberg on the playing on defense, got to get him some shifts, and then you got to get a way to get Jeff Skinner out of there and put in Kapanen. That would be my big thing, and then put Stuart Skinner in goal if you'd like. To me, that doesn't really matter. The main thing I am looking forward to is to see how Edmonton start the game, because for some reason, the Oilers in games, games 3, 4, and 5. This is 3 games in a row now where they have just started completely flat. Game 3, Marchand scores, a minute in? Game 4, they were down 3-0, and they show tremendous grit and heart to come back in that game, to win that game. But a horrendous start. And then on Saturday, just a dreadful start. They had 3 shots, I think, in the first period. The building's rocking. You win a dramatic game 4 in overtime. The entire city's juiced. You have home ice. If you just take care of your business in Edmonton, you win the Stanley Cup, and you come out flat like that. So that would be a concern for me for Edmonton that I want to see in game number 6. Come out fiery. Come out desperate, because this is your last chance. No more losses. You lose this one, you're gone. You lose this one, and you're gone. And for 2 years in a row, you'll be looking at the Florida Panthers in their own building lifting up the Stanley Cup. And to me, I didn't realize, I know Hyman's a great player. He's been a much bigger loss for the Oilers than I thought. Not saying I don't think Zach Hyman's a great player. He is a very good player. But he was bringing something new to the Oilers this year. On the forecheck, getting in on pucks, hitting people. He was a great compliment, whether it was with McDavid or Draisaitl. He just fit either of them perfectly. So that's been a much bigger loss than I thought. And we need more from Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. I know he's a bit injured, and he played well in Game 4, got the first goal in the comeback. But he's clearly not healthy. Because in that Dallas series, Leon Draisaitl said it. He was their best player. And he has not been anywhere close to that so far this series. So I'm interested to see. Edmonton have to come out quick. They cannot start off flat again, because I feel like Florida is just going to be a buzzsaw after that. So the Oilers getting the first goal would be huge, and putting some pressure on Florida. But it's been a fantastic series thus far. 3 games into overtime, and then 2 Florida blowouts. And I'm stunned at how well Brad Marchand is playing. It's remarkable. Him at his age, him and Sam Bennett in this playoff run have made themselves a lot of money. Whether they stay in Florida, whether they go to Toronto, whether they go to Montreal, go to Detroit, Chicago, wherever those guys go, they have made themselves a ton of money based on their play in the postseason, because they have both been outstanding in these playoffs. And I got to give Bobrovsky some credit, too. He's made some big saves. He's just a steady, sturdy goaltender. He hasn't done anything spectacular. Maybe a bit in Game 2 for a bit. He made some big saves. But outside of that, Bob's just been sturdy. He was good. He was very good in Game 3. I'll give him that as well. Games 2 and 3, he was phenomenal. And he's just There's no question marks with goaltending with Florida. Edmonton, every damn series is a question mark. Oh, is Skinner plays bad? We put in Pickard. If Bobrovsky has a bad game, no one's like, oh, are we going to put in Vanecek? That's not happening. That's not happening. It's Sergei Bobrovsky's net, and everyone knows it, and he has played pretty darn well in the Cup Finals so far this year. So Florida, well on their way right now, but still, it's 3-2, and Edmonton's still alive. But the way Florida played in Game 5 with their forecheck, their penalty kill was outstanding. It was remarkable. Their defense is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Seth Jones, what a pickup he was. Look at those deadline additions by the Florida Panthers. Marshawn and Jones were the big one, and they are playing huge roles for them right now. Absolutely huge. That third line has just been phenomenal. Phenomenal. Marshawn, Lindell, Forsling, it's just fantastic. I keep drawing a blank on his name. Ristolainen and Marchand and Lindell have just been phenomenal. And imagine if Tkachuk was fully healthy. And you have Sam Bennett, you have Reinhardt, you have Ekblad. Defensively, they're just remarkable. Ekblad, Seth Jones, Schmidt's done a really nice job for them. Gustav Forsling's been phenomenal. Kulikov, they are so sturdy on the back end, Florida. Then you put Bobrovsky in net. Then you have those four lines. Like, Thomas Nosek was playing on the Bruins' second line a few years ago. Now he's their fourth-line center in Florida. Brad Marchand's on their third line. They're just a very deep hockey team, and they're in the driver's seat right now to win back-to-back Stanley Cup titles. But they still, you know, Edmonton's going to come in hungry, and I pray that they get off to a good start. They need to get off to a good start. Quickly to the NBA Finals. It is 2-2 between the Indiana Pacers and the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Pacers were looking to take a 3-1 lead. I believe that was on Friday night. Yes, on Friday. And they had the 10-point lead going to the fourth quarter, had a lead late in the fourth quarter, but SGA and the Thunder had other ideas. 111-104, just a phenomenal clutch game from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He had 35 points in the win. Lou Dort defensively, though, man, the Montreal guy is doing phenomenal things. And we have to give Oklahoma City a ton of credit and their entire front office. Getting Alex Caruso, what a deal that was. He was clutch on Friday night. He hit 7 of 9 shots. Defensively does everything. And Sam Presti, it was just a clinical trade by them. Nothing against was the kid, the Australian kid they sent over to Chicago. Getting Caruso back was just a phenomenal addition. And nothing, I get why Chicago did it. They needed more creativity. That was named Giddy, Josh Giddy. Giddy was a good player. He's a tall, good point guard, good passer. But they had SGA. SGA was running the show. They needed just more defense and opportune, just phenomenal scoring, clutch shot making. And that's exactly what Alex Caruso is and what he does and what he represents. Plays phenomenal, tenacious defense, and he hits big shots, and he made some big ones on Friday night against the Pacers. So we go back to Oklahoma City tonight, 8:30 tip. The Pacers and the Thunder looking for a 3-2 series lead. Cannot wait for that one. But everyone keeps writing off Indiana. Oklahoma City were the huge favorites coming into the series. Indiana steal game one the way they did, and then they looked great at home in game three. And now all of a sudden they lose a game that they should have won, and now everyone's on the Oklahoma City Thunder bandwagon. To me, Oklahoma City are the favorite just because they're the better team. The whole year, they've been the best team in the league. They went through unbelievable competition to get here. But I can't rule out Indiana. I'm not just going to say the series is over like a lot of people. Like, oh, Indiana blew their shot. This is it. No. Every time Indiana's been faced with adversity, they have come back and have played well the next game. And that's a fact. Look what they did in that Cleveland series. Look what they did against the Knicks. They are a resilient group. They're well coached by Rick Carlisle, and that's going to be a learning experience, them having that lead going into the fourth quarter, having a late lead late in the fourth quarter. Rick Carlisle will trust me. He will make them make them remember how to play basketball late. Trust me. I know Rick Carlisle, what he did with Dallas, what he did with Detroit back in the day. He's a phenomenal basketball coach. And he says, guys, that sucks, but it's a learning. It's a learning moment for us. If you look at Oklahoma City, they were going down 3-1 in a series where you were heavily favored would have been a lot to handle, so that was huge for them. Get back home court. But I am not ruling out the Indiana Pacers. I'm done doing that. Didn't think they'd beat Cleveland. Thought they had a chance. I was not high on them beating the Knicks from what I saw from New York against Boston, and they proved me wrong twice. So I am not hopping off the Indiana Pacers bandwagon right now. I like them better than a lot of people going into the NBA Finals just because they have a heartbreaking loss. Not going to jump off, but hey, that was a tough one. But I expect them to play well. Halliburton's got to be better. Siakam's doing his thing. They just need the surrounding cast to pick it up a bit more, which they did that in Game 1. Obi Toppin was going crazy in Game 1. They need more performances like that from the rest of their roster. But I expect Indiana, honestly, to play well. I expect Indiana to play well. I expect Turner to play much better. Nembhard needs to play much better. Neesmith, listen, he's maybe the streakiest player of all time. He really is. And if he plays well, Indiana tends to win. If he doesn't, they're in trouble. But there's a lot of guys in Indiana who can come out and support Halliburton, support Siakam. Sorry, that was a tongue twister. Support Siakam. Got it down there. There's a lot of great players on Indiana that can help their two all-stars, so I really think Indiana's going to play with them. Whether they win, they're huge underdogs, that's a different story. But to act like these teams are not on the same level anymore is crazy. They pulled minus 700 Oklahoma City at the beginning of the series. Minus 700 the Thunder were. That's crazy. Indiana's far better than that, and they're going to give them a hell of a series, which they have done so far. It's 2-2 going into Game 5 tonight in Oklahoma City. Quickly to Major League Baseball, and it was not a great weekend for the New York Yankees, who went up to Boston to face their arch rival, and they got destroyed over the weekend. The Red Sox bats got to them and swept the New York Yankees. It wasn't dominant fashion, but if you lose those three games, that's a killer. 2-1, 4-3, 2-0. All close games for the Yankees. Cannot get it done. The Red Sox now, one of the hottest teams in baseball. They've won 5 in a row, 8 of 10. And you think you would keep your team together after that. You think, you know what? No, we're playing good baseball. We had this great roster, the young players, the old veterans. It's going to work. They finally start playing well, and then the Red Sox decide, after all this time, to trade Rafael Devers. Their best hitter, one of the best hitters in baseball, one of the best left-handed bats in the sport. He's gone to the San Francisco Giants in a five-player blockbuster. The Red Sox traded Devers to San Francisco for right-hander Jordan Hicks, left-hander Kyle Harrison, a pair of prospects, and James Tibbs. And I believe the other prospect is Jose Bayo for Rafael Devers. And it's a full salary dump. The $200-something million left in his contract will be taken by the Giants. And as a Red Sox fan, listen, was he a headache this whole year? Yes, he was. When Bregman showed up to play third base, and they asked him to be DH, was he thrilled? No, he was not. When Casas got injured and they asked him to play first base, was he thrilled? No, he was not. But he was asked a few days ago, I think over this weekend, if that was behind them. He said yes. And judging by Devers' play, he clearly put it behind him. He was playing outstanding. He was walking a lot more. Hit a few home runs over the weekend. Devers is a Yankees killer as well. Always hits well against the Yankees. And now the Red Sox, finally playing good baseball, won 5 in a row, decide to trade him for, okay, some prospects and relievers. But you telling me you couldn't got that later on, closer to the deadline? I heard the Braves are interested, the Padres are interested, the Blue Jays are interested because of Guerrero and Devers are great friends. You tell me they could not have gotten more than what they gotten. Nothing against Hicks and Harrison and all those prospects. Fair enough. Maybe it works out. But as of right now, that is a least on paper, a horrendous deal for the Red Sox. Now, I'm not in the clubhouse. I'm not in the locker room to know what he's doing around there. But clearly, the Red Sox front office did not like how he handled that situation with Bregman at third base, with him not wanting to be a DH, with him not wanting to play first base. It was just a disaster. And it results in the Red Sox trading their best hitter to San Francisco for a bunch of arms. And I like the young prospects. I like Roman Anthony. I like Meyer. I like Campbell. I like all these pieces. But they're young. And now they are pretty much the faces of the franchise. Crochet's a great pitcher, don't get me wrong. He's probably the face right now, but he only pitches one every 5 days. Who, Bregman? He might opt out after this year. The one key piece, the cornerstone of your franchise for the next 8 years was going to be Rafael Devers. And now he's just gone. And we'll see if this works out. But in recent memory, Red Sox trading star players, Mookie Betts, hasn't worked out. And my initial thoughts on this trade is I don't think it's going to work out. But I don't understand. The Red Sox finally playing well, finally hitting well, finally winning games against quality teams. And they go out and they trade Devers now. They don't wait to the deadline. Maybe when they can get more, they go and trade him right now. And I heard a report that they called the Giants. Why don't you start a bidding war? You know how valuable a right-handed power bat is in Major League Baseball and you just gave them away for a few relievers and prospects? Give me a break. That's a joke. And I know Devers was off to one of the worst starts in Major League Baseball history. He was like 0 for 18, 0 for 19 to start the year. But since then, he has been scorching hot, on fire, one of the best hitters in baseball. And now, I don't know where the Red Sox offense is going to come from. Duran, Abreu, these three rookies are going to turn into Ty Cobb, Mickey Mantle. I don't see it, at least right now. They're going to be great players. They're three of the seven best prospects in baseball, but they're in their early 20s. So to expect them to carry you the rest of the year, that's a bit of a heavy, heavy burden to have. And I'm interested to see. I'm going to watch Devers' first game in San Francisco. Probably watch him go yard and then think, huh, he could have been playing against the Mariners tonight in our lineup. Rafael Devers on the year had 15 home runs, 58 RBIs already. And how bad he was to start the year, 0 for 20, he's got his batting average above 270 at 272. He was heating up. And he was, I believe, five walks away from tying his high or breaking his high of walks in a season. So he's had a much better eye, wasn't swinging at junk, was walking more, forcing pitchers to throw more to him, and he was taking advantage over the last 2 months. So Breslow and Henry and the people at Fenway Sports Group, they better have gotten this one right. Because if they don't, and this Devers thing just completely backfires on him, that will be two all-star caliber players that you got rid of who were on world championship teams trading to the NL West and you getting nothing out of it. This is the Boston Red Sox we're talking about. Not the Pittsburgh Pirates, not the Arizona Diamondbacks, not the Colorado Rockies, not the Oakland A's. This is the Boston Red Sox. And they need to be reminded about that. That they're one of the great organizations in baseball. That they're one of the biggest sports teams in America. They have one of the biggest brands in America. And they have deep pockets. They need to be reminded about that. Because this is crazy. Just trading star players in their primes when they're playing well. If they traded Devers 2 months ago when he was 0 for 19, he was being a locker room cancer and all those things, fair enough, get him out of there. But now the Red Sox are finally playing well and Devers is hitting like a madman, now we're going to trade him. And also, if you're planning on trading him, wouldn't you wait closer to the deadline to get bidders? Maybe call Atlanta. Maybe call the Padres. Maybe call other teams, the Texas Rangers and people like that. Oh, we want to deal them to the National League. Okay, call the Phillies. Call the Mets. Call those teams. And start a bidding war so you can get more assets. To get what they got is shocking. And nothing against Hicks and Harrison. As I'm saying, they're good players. Do they equate to Rafael Devers? Those two players and those prospects? Probably not. So I don't understand it. I don't understand it at all. And we'll see if Bregman opts out at the end of the year. There's a whole bunch of things that could happen that will immediately put all the pressure on those three young kids. And guess what? If they're great, they'll handle it. But Roman Anthony's been in big leagues for a week. Meyer's been in, 3 weeks? And Campbell's, this is 2.5 months? And they're already carrying your franchise, along with Duran. Seems like a lot for me. It really does. So this better work out. And I feel like Red Sox fans, I know people call us complainers and overreactors, since that Mookie Betts deal and then letting Xander go for nothing and now losing Devers, I feel like we have a right to be a bit like, what the hell is going on in the front office? They've made some good moves. I liked bringing in Bregman. That crochet deal was fantastic. He's been phenomenal. We have young prospects. Okay, great. But the recent trades with the Red Sox, when they trade all-star players, they have all completely backfired. And I'm fearing that this one will backfire as well. So that's a quick little recap on the big trade that happened yesterday. Rafael Devers, if you missed it, the third baseman / DH all-star caliber, three-time all-star. Rafael Devers traded to the San Francisco Giants for 5 players and prospects. So that happened last night. And we'll quickly get into the Blue Jays. They were red hot, but they got swept over the weekend by the Philadelphia Phillies and now have a big, big series coming up at home against the Arizona Diamondbacks, which starts tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. They have 3 against the Diamondbacks. Then they got 3 against the White Sox. So this is a big stretch coming up for the Blue Jays, looking to get back on track after a bad weekend in Philadelphia. So we will get into all that as well. Quickly over to Formula One. And it was all over the city this weekend in Montreal. Grand Prix weekend. One of the craziest, most hectic times in Montreal. Just beautiful weather. The last few years, it's been rainy and muggy. It was cool. Beautiful weather. I went on Friday to the practice. Early in the practice. And that was great. Got to see some amazing drivers. And the whole event, they have the Heineken Garden and everything. It was great. Absolutely great. We'll get to the race itself. And it's George Russell getting his first win of the year for Mercedes. Max Verstappen second. Kimi Antonelli, the youngster from Mercedes, finishing third. That's your podium. Oscar Piastri of McLaren in fourth. Charles Leclerc, Ferrari in fifth. Lewis Hamilton of Ferrari in sixth. But the big headline was Lando Norris crashing with, 3 laps to go, resulting in a safety car, and that ended the race pretty much. They just had the safety car until the end. But Lando Norris trying to make up points. He's behind his teammate in the Formula One driver standings, and he went for a very aggressive move on his teammate, and he ends up crashing into the wall, out of the race, costing himself big points, probably at least 12 points. And just really not the brightest move by Lando Norris there. I believe we have Lando Norris's comments following him crashing into the wall with his teammate Oscar Piastri.
We heard you say on the radio, my bad, my fault. Was it just going for a gap that you thought would be there and wasn't in the end? Talk me through it.
Yeah, pretty much. No one to blame but myself, so I apologize to the whole team and to Oscar as well for attempting something probably a bit too silly. So, glad I didn't ruin his race. And again, apologies to the team.
Did you at any point say, can you let me through on faster?
But
no discussions. I mean, it's a tough battle when it's your teammate you're fighting in the championship, isn't it? And I guess we'd said, and you'd said, Zach had said, it's going to happen at some point. It's out the way now.
Yeah, but, you know, this was just more silly. You know, this wasn't even like a... Yeah, that's racing. It was just... yeah, silly from my part, so...
How'd you reset for Austria?
I go to bed tonight and... Yeah. Apologise to everyone and then crack on.
So that was Lando Norris after crashing there. And that was really the big thing. Not saying it was a boring race, but it was pretty standard. And then clearly, Lando Norris feeling the pressure from his teammate, Oscar Piastri, ahead of him in the driver's standings, leading the way in the driver's championship. And he was looking to make up some points, and he crashes into the wall, costing himself at least 12, maybe even 10 points there. And now the lead for Oscar Piastri is 22 points ahead of his teammate. Max Verstappen picking up some points as well. He's up in the third place, 155 points. But it's still Oscar Piastri leading the way, Lando Norris, Max Verstappen, George Russell, the top four in the Drivers' Championship standings. We're going to get into a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk about that wild U.S. Open over the weekend. We were expecting Rory's name. We were expecting Scottie Scheffler's name, Bryson DeChambeau's name to be up there. We did not get any of those stars, but we got absolute mania on the back nine at Oakmont. So we will get into that after the break, as well as my thoughts coming up on Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final tomorrow. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. Back after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
Suoni Pearl Popolo and Dreamscapes on CJLO present 10 Years of Metonymy Press, a cabaret, live at Casa del Popolo on Sunday, June 22nd at 8 p.m. For 10 years, Metonymy Press has been publishing queer, trans, and feminist literature by emerging writers, trying to reduce barriers for authors who interrogate the status quo to produce stunning, multi-genre books that reframe power and affirm life. This decade of Metonymy Press will be celebrated in the company of H. Felix Chow Bradley, Shanice Nicole, Kamala Mackerel, Trish Sala, Eli Tarek L. Bechelani Lynch, Kai Cheng Tom, and Jia King Wilson Yang. Don't miss out. Tickets and more information can be found on SwoniePearlPopolo.org, and keep listening to CGLO for more features on everything Swoney related.
The best new music from around the globe, with a respectful nod to the musical pioneers of the past and a whole lot more. Join me, Danny Payne, on The Pressure Drop every Monday at 5 on CGLO 1690 AM or CGLO.com.
Back here on Tommy John Show. So I'm just seeing now they're announcing the first six players to make the Olympic rosters for hockey coming up in February. Cannot believe NHLers are back at the Olympics, and we got a bit of a taste for it at the Four Nations a few months ago, which was phenomenal. Did absolutely huge numbers in the ratings in Canada and the U.S. and really put a massive spotlight on hockey again, which was great. So each team, the big nations, have announced their first six players. And no surprises, really, when you look at it. For Team Canada, Sidney Crosby, Nathan MacKinnon, Connor McDavid, Braden Point, Sam Reinhart, Cale Makar, the first six players named to Canada. Absolutely zero shockers there. Zero. Especially the way Reinhart's played in the playoffs, especially how he played last year. Defensively, he scored 50-something goals last year and got to the playoffs over 60 goals last year. Those six were absolutely locks. So they are the first six named to Team Canada. To the United States, again, zero surprises. Jack Eichel, Austin Matthews, Brady Tkachuk, Matthew Tkachuk, Quinn Hughes, Charlie McAvoy, the first six named to the U.S. team. If we head to Sweden, it's Adrian Kempe of the Kings, Gabriel Landeskog, William Nylander, Lucas Raymond, Rasmus Dahlin, Victor Hedman. So those are all great options as well. Finland, Sebastian Aho from the Hurricanes, Alexander Barkov on Florida, no surprise, Mikko Rantanen, Heiskanen, Lindell, Saros. That's a nice little lineup right there. Head to the Czechs, Martin Nikas, Andre Palat, David Pasternak, Pavel Zacha, Ratko Gudas, and Lukas Dostal are the picks for the Czechs. And Germany, no surprise, Leon Draisaitl, Lucas Reichel, Nico Sturm, Tim Stützle, Moritz Seider, and Philip Grubauer were named for them. And quickly to Slovakia, Martin Pospisil, Juraj Slafkovský, Tomáš Tatar, Erik Černák, Martin Fehervy, and Simon Nemec, the initial names for Slovakia. There you go. We're missing Russia. I know it's not ideal. We would love to have Russia there. But yeah, there you have it. Those are the initial players named to the big nations of, I guess, what are we, June? So in February, you're getting there in a few months' time. At the Milan Olympics. So those, Canada, the U.S., Sweden, no surprises there. And I cannot wait to see how the rest of these rosters shape up. So quickly to the U.S. Open, which was just absolute chaos on the back nine, especially even the whole round in total. So J.J. Spahn opened the tournament with a 66. And if you don't know J.J. Spahn's story, he won, I guess, a few years ago on the tour. Was thinking last year, he was outside the top 125 for your PGA Tour card. And he was thinking, you know what, if I don't make it, I had a great run. I was on the tour for a bunch of years. You know what, maybe enter the next part of my life. But to his credit, at the end of last year, he got on an absolute heater. Finished high up in events and got his tour card for this year. And he has totally taken advantage of that opportunity. He, remember, played phenomenal at the Cognizant. Played unbelievable at the Players. He was, what, an inch away from winning? If that putt rolls another inch, he wins the Players' Championship. Instead, he goes to a playoff the next day against Rory McIlroy. Loses that one, and the pressure got to him. But still, he said he learned a lot from that week. That bought him some time and some much needed PGA Tour points to keep him on the tour for the foreseeable future. And what did he do this week? His ball striking was phenomenal. And he opened with a 66, kind of was just hanging around. It's Oakmont, one of the hardest courses you'll ever find. The winning score was going to be over par. He was hanging in there. And then it looked like it was all unraveling on Sunday afternoon. His first six holes, he was five over par on his first six holes. And he got screwed on the second hole. He had a great wedge and hit the flag stick, rolled all the way down to the front of the green. Instead of making a birdie, he makes a bogey. And he said it was hard, but once they had that rain delay, he said, you know what, I'm just going to fire at pins and go at it. And did he do that with one of the great back nines in U.S. Open history. And while that was going on, you had the likes of Sam Burns, Adam Scott, Tyrrell Hatton, this Ortiz guy, just trying to hold on. And Sam Burns, we'll talk about that decision on the 15th hole, him not getting a drop. That was wild. He did not have his best stuff at all. He shot an 8 over. But he had the lead on the back 9, and he birdied the 10th hole, and it looked like Sam Burns was the guy to catch. Just completely unraveled. Doubled 11. I think he doubled 13 as well. Adam Scott was no better. It was just brutal conditions, wet, rainy, hard golf course that played even longer. Victor Hovland was around there, and it looked like the people staying in the clubhouse at four over, John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler, they might have a chance because these players are falling backwards, and they're in the clubhouse. We might have a playoff. But Robert McIntyre made some big shots, and he posted that one over number two under on the day, and J.J. Spahn, going to his final two holes, knew he had to go one under. One under on his last two holes to win the U.S. Open. Made a great birdie on 12 and on 14. He hit maybe the shot of his life, the tee shot in the 17, the drivable par 4. Hits it to about 15 feet, two putts for birdie. Now he's standing on the 18th tee at Oakmont Country Club, needing a par to win the U.S. Open. And he hit a great tee shot, a very conservative second shot, which left him 70 feet. 70 feet. To two putt from there to win the U.S. Open. And luckily for him, don't want to say it happens all the time, Victor Hovland hit his shot just behind his, so he got a perfect look at the putt on the green. He saw exactly what Hovland's putt did, and he took advantage, and he drilled, absolutely drilled, a 70-foot putt, which no one saw coming. Hits it, and J.J. Spahn birdied the last two holes. He only needed the par of the last one, but he birdied the last two to win the U.S. Open. And one of the stranger events you'll ever see. I don't know anyone who had J.J. Spahn as their winner at Oakmont this week. It was Scottie Scheffler at plus 280. It was Bryson DeChambeau, John Rahm. Maybe Rory's driver shows up. No, no, no. It was J.J. Spahn from Los Angeles, California, winning the U.S. Open. Here was Spahn after his surprising victory on Father's Day weekend.
It felt like as bad as things were going, like, I just still tried to just commit to every shot. I tried to just continue to dig deep. I mean, I've been doing it my whole life. And I think that's been the biggest difference this year, is being able to do that. And fortunately, you know, I dug very deep on the back nine, and you know, things went my way, and here we are with the trophy.
Yeah, you work for this your whole life. No one can ever take that away from you. Where did this dream start, and you know, how do you put this moment into words?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up watching golf. I was a young kid, wanted to play golf. I loved golf. It was a passion for me growing up, and, you know, always played with my parents growing up, and, you know, one thing led to another. I wasn't really groomed to be like a professional golfer. I didn't, you know, get put through academies. I didn't play the AJGA. I played local stuff. I did qualify for actually my first big USGA event, which was the US Junior. I did that, two times when I was like 16 and 17. And that's kind of when I realized my potential. But I just kept going like one foot in front of the other, and, you know, junior golf, college golf, turning pro, and now here I am with the U.S. Open trophy.
So that's J.J. Spahn, an unlikely champion, a great story, and honestly, that playoff loss to Rory McIlroy must have did him wonders, just knowing that he can compete at the biggest golf tournaments. And if you don't know, you have the four majors in golf. The Players is like the fifth major. It's the biggest event on the PGA Tour, the strongest field. All the top players play. And he was right there losing in a playoff, and it did him wonders. As crazy as it sounds now, people thought he just, the moment was too big for him, playing against a legend in Rory McIlroy, who would go on to win the Masters a month later, was playing his peak golf. Peak golf from Rory, and this guy was right there with him. So that gave him a lot of confidence, he said. And he, boy, did he play well. It was that opening round 66, but even after that, people were skeptical. We've seen a bunch of players who no one really expects to be high up on the leaderboard, play well, be there after one round, heading into the weekend, and then usually on the weekend, they fall back and crumble a bit. But J.J. Spahn, it was heading in that direction, and he completely turned it around following that rain delay. Five over on his first six holes, the turning it around and shooting one under par, I think they said, one under for the day. I don't know if that was true, but he was out of his mind. out of his mind on the back nine yesterday. And if you look at the holes he birdied 12, birdied 14. Who the hell birdies 18? He was two over yesterday. Sorry, one under for the tournament. That's right, one under for the tournament. Considering where he was, the battle back on that back nine was remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Birdied 12, birdied 14, birdied 17, birdied 18. Comes in 32 to win the U.S. Open. And look at that scorecard on the front. Five of the first six holes bogeyed. And for a player who does not have the winning experience like a J.J. Spahn, that unravels them into an 80. Or 78, your T18, T19, thanks for coming. Next year, just try and eliminate those bogeys. That's what would have been said next year on the broadcast normally. But J.J. Spahn put his head down, and he hit some phenomenal shots in that back nine. And I was waiting for the bigger names to do something. Scottie Scheffler, for a minute, had a chance. He was late at plus three. He was hanging around. Victor Hovland, he was the one I thought was going to win the tournament when we were going to the back nine. I thought Sam Burns and Adam Scott, the moment might get to them. Adam Scott had not been in major contention for a long time. Sam Burns, still, I know it was a PGA Tour event, let one slip last week in Canada. I really like, I'm like, look at that leaderboard. Victor Hovland and Tyrrell Hatton are the big names, and I feel like Victor Hovland, he's already won this year. He's going to be the guy. And I picked the right group, just the wrong player. But J.J. Spahn played with Hovland, and he played lights out on the back nine. And now, after the U.S. Open, we only have one more major left in the season. It is next month at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland, the 100 and whatever it now, 50-something Open Championship from Royal Portrush. And I got to tell you, after this, I have no idea. To me, it was Scheffler, DeChambeau, Schauffele. I thought the winner was going to come from one of those guys. Now that you see it, this reminded us that golf, anything can happen. Because we were going through a trend right now in 2025 where Scheffler was winning, where Rory was winning. It was all the Hovland. It was all the big boys were winning the big-time tournaments. And then the narrative became, is this golf turning more into tennis, where you see the big boys winning all the events all the time? They become so good. And once we had the biggest favorite in U.S. Open history since Tiger Woods, we had the most unexpected winner. 120-1 to start the week. 120-1 J.J. Spahn was. And he wins the 125th U.S. Open. On a golf course where you would think a top five player would win, because it is such a hard track. You have to hit fairways. You have to hit the ball far. J.J. Spahn, he doesn't hit the ball like Scottie Scheffler. He doesn't hit the ball like Rory McIlroy. He doesn't hit the ball like Bryson DeChambeau, John Rahm, Victor Hovland. But what he did, he found fairways on the back nine, and he hit some incredible iron shots. But he was there since round one. Shot a 66, led after round one, hung around in rounds two and three, and even when the conditions got brutal yesterday, he made his run. And now you got to think he's going to, this can go one of two ways. Is J.J. Spahn going to be a constant atop of leaderboards now? Or is this just like a one-time thing? And it's such a great story, and he's a great player, and you like to think with that win yesterday, J.J. Spahn's going to be on that Ryder Cup team at Bethpage Black in a few months' time. He's for sure on it. They got two major champions this year, Scottie Scheffler, and now J.J. Spahn. I'd be stunned if they don't take him. So J.J. Spahn, the winner of the 125th U.S. Open from Oakmont Country Club. Just amazing. We're going to get into our second break, and when we come back, I'll talk a bit about Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final, which takes place tomorrow in Florida, and some other news in the NFL to get to. My name is Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. We'll be back right after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
Festival Bleu Bleu, presented by SiriusXM, is back for its seventh edition. From June 20th to 23rd, Carlton-sur-Mer will come alive with performances by Ariane Roy, Petit Beliveau, Clopel Gag, High Classified, Uri, Gus Engelhorn, Belly, Maggie Merlin, and many more. Don't miss the epic Beach Electro Night, the Artisan Market, the Classic Mussels and Fries Dinner, the Water Skipping Tournament, and plenty other fun activities. Contact your friends and plan your Gaspésie getaway. Tickets and details at festivalbleubleu.com.
Welcome, salutations and various forms of greetings, friends. My name is Mr. Billets. When I'm not enjoying good ragtime music and tap dancing, I like to listen to Great Explosives on Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. on CJLO 1690 AM. Now here's some kind of a cover of Frank Sinatra by a metal band. Take that, Hitler!
Back here at Tommy John Show. So that big news I'm talking about in the NFL, it involves the Cincinnati Bengals and star pass rusher Trey Hendrickson. They have resumed contract talks. It is happening. They are back in a room negotiating, and we'll see if a deal gets done. The Bengals are really having a rough time locking up these pass rushers. Their first-round pick, Shamar Stewart, they can't get that deal done, even though the money's set. Just about when the contract can be voidable, after which years. It's just a whole other situation going on in Cincinnati. And Trey Hendrickson, he's one of the best pass rushers in football. They gave him permission to seek a trade. Nothing's happened yet. That was back in March when they told me he can do that. Now they're sitting down looking like they're going to get a deal done. But this is what happens. Nothing against paying Ja'Marr Chase. I would pay him every day of the week. But you gave your number two receiver in T. Higgins, who's an unbelievable player. You gave him a huge contract as well. Plus, Joe Burrow got a $275 million contract. You know, it adds up. And now what do you think? Trey Hendrickson's going to take a pay cut to stay with the Bengals? No. He's looking around to get the most money he can. He's in his early 30s. He led the NFL in sacks last year. He's looking to cash out. He wants a new contract. And now we see the Bengals and him are negotiating, which is good to see. It's positive for Cincinnati. It looked like he was for sure gone, not coming back. At least now they're talking. So that's good. That's big news for Bengals fans looking to get that deal done as we head closer and closer to NFL training camp next month. Game 6 tomorrow night, my prediction. I'm rooting for Edmonton. Even though as a Bruins fan, I want Marshawn to do well. They need to get to a better start. That is the key to the game. They cannot start these games like they did in games 3, 4, and 5 and expect to win. They can't. They're going to need to come out physical, aggressive, play like it's their last game ever, which it could be, at least for this season. And you don't know when you're going to get back to a Stanley Cup final. That's what was so heartbreaking last year with the Oilers, because we didn't know. As great as McDavid is, there's no guarantee you can get back to a cup final. It's not guaranteed. Just because Crosby won 3 cups, just because Messier won 6 cups, just because all these legends win cups doesn't mean it's automatic. So McDavid and Draisaitl, listen, there's no, as great as they are, there's no guarantees they get back to a cup final. This is why it's so important for them tomorrow night. They better play like the two best players on the planet, which they are, and take it to Florida and try and get this thing back to Edmonton for Game 7 on Friday. That is the goal. So our next show will recap the NBA and Stanley Cup Finals. We will have champions in those, as well as preview Wimbledon. That is right around the corner with the grass season kicking off right now. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next Monday, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on CJLO 1690 AM.
Hello.